John Wesley, the man who founded the Methodist Church, had a tragic thing happen to him when he was a child. The house in which he lived caught on fire. His mom and dad scurried around the house and did the best they could to get all the kids out of the house. And since they had a whole bunch of kids, they got them out on the lawn before they realized one was missing. Counted them up, and there was one not there. And to their horror, they looked up, and there in an upstairs window stood little six-year-old John looking out at his parents as the house was beginning to be engulfed in flames. His father was an Anglican minister, and being the good, pious man that he was, he dropped to his knees there in the lawn and began to pray and cry out and beg God to save his son from this fire. While he was on his knees praying, John's mother ran next door. With the help of a neighbor, they got a ladder, came over, climbed up on the second story, got John out of the house, and saved his life. There's a time to pray, and there's a time to get a ladder. And wouldn't you know it, you know, men being as pious as they are would be praying, and practical women would be saving the day with a ladder, right? I think that sometimes we give the impression, just through the way we approach things, that when you come to church, that mostly what we're concerned about is just praying and talking to God and communicating with Him and reading your Bible, and that that's really all that matters in life. And the reality is that what you do with your time, how you approach your world, how you work, that's all important to God as well. God's just not interested in simply having everybody sitting around praying all the time. God wants you to be effective in what you do with your day-to-day life. And so we're going to begin a two-part series on work from the book of Proverbs, because Proverbs has a lot to say about the whole issue of work. But before we go there, I want you to turn to Colossians chapter 3, because there's a very important passage in Colossians chapter 3 in verses 23 and 24. Colossians chapter 3, verses 23 and 24. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 23, Paul is writing and he says these words. He says, whatever you do. Now, what would that include? Just about everything, right? Whatever you do, he says, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Now here in this passage, he says that whatever you set out to do, whatever you endeavor to do, whether it's school, whether it's work, whether it's play, whatever you do, he says, work at it with all your heart. Be wholehearted. Put your whole self into it. Why? Not to please men, not to look good to people, not to have a boss pat you on the back or the teacher give you an A or someone to give you a raise. That's not the reason why you do it. You do it because your ultimate boss is the Lord Jesus Christ. It's Jesus Christ who's ultimately going to reward you. And so whatever you put yourself into, you ought to work at it. Put your whole self, your whole heart, your whole motivation into it. Now with that as a preamble, what we want to do this morning is we want to look at the book of Proverbs. And in the book of Proverbs, there are a number of attitudes or approaches to work that are discussed. And today we're going to discuss three negative characteristics or attitudes by which people approach work. Now, next week when we come back, we'll talk about the three or four positive ones. But this week, I want to show you three approaches to avoid when it comes to the way we approach life. The first one is what we call the lazy approach to life, or the no-work person, who we call the no-work person. Turn back to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 6. In Proverbs chapter 6, we are introduced to the lazy or the no-work person. Proverbs chapter 6, starting with verse 6, it says, go to the ant, you sluggard. Now, the word sluggard is the Old Testament word for the lazy person. He says, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. Now, you have to be pretty low if you can learn from an ant, right? You can see in the book of Proverbs, there's not a lot of real sympathetic, patient, kind words for the person who's lazy by nature. He says, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer, and it gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man. Now, when we talk about a sluggard is the person who decides that they're going to take the path of least resistance. You've run into people who say, you know, why knock yourself out? You know, there are a lot of people in this world that are willing to knock themselves out, but I take the path of least resistance. I do as little as I can to get by. Mañana is my favorite term. You know, tomorrow, I'll get around to it. Well, that person is condemned, and that approach to life is condemned. And really, the book of Proverbs gives three characteristics of the lazy or the no-work person. The first characteristic is this. A no-work person minimizes the value of a minute. They minimize the value of a minute. In Proverbs chapter 6, verse 10, it says, a little slumber, a little sleep, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, scarcity like an armed man. Now that little sleep, little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, that's the favorite line of the lazy person. Notice that it's not a lot of slumber. It's not a lot of sleep. It's not a lot of laying on the couch. That's not what the person's saying. It's just a little bit more than what I'm doing right now. And you know what'll happen a minute from now? I just need to do a little bit more of what I just got done doing. And then a few minutes from now, I just need to do a little bit more. In other words, this person does not understand that minutes add up to hours, and hours add up to days, and days add up to weeks, and months, and years, and a lifetime. And before you know it, a little more rest, I'll get to it in a minute, I'm just taking my time, I go at my own pace, I do as little as I can to get by, turns into a lifetime of unproductivity. Rudyard Kipling, in his poem about what it means to be a man, called If, made this comment. He said, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. Now, he describes a minute as unforgiving, and you know why? Because it is. A minute clicks away, 60 seconds, moving at its pace, regardless of what you're doing. Have you ever tried to say to the clock, wait, I'm not quite ready? What happens? Just keeps right on ticking, doesn't it? The Energizer Bunny, you know, just keeps right on going. A minute is unforgiving. And a quality person understands the value of not wasting a minute on lazy pursuits. The second characteristic is that a lazy person finds excuses in everything. They find excuses in everything. I love Proverbs 22:13. It says, the sluggard says, there's a lion outside. Or, I will be murdered in the street. Well, how do you know until you go out there? Well, I just want to make sure that I don't get myself overdone, you know. I just need to be careful. I need to guard my priorities. How many people have guarded their priorities to the point where they've done nothing? Just want to make sure that I don't get overcommitted. Well, what are you committed to? Well, I'm committed to making sure I don't get overcommitted. That's my commitment. It's a person that's constantly coming up with excuses for why they can't get going. The third characteristic is the lazy person thinks he is beating the system. The lazy person thinks he is beating the system. Notice 26:16. It says, the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who answer discreetly. If you take seven very intelligent men, you line them all up, and they say it's blue, and the sluggard says it's green, the sluggard truly believes that he or she is right. You guys have seen this before. You know, it's the person who says, let them knock themselves out. Let them beat their head against the wall. Let them keep working. I'm just going to sit back and I'm going to take it easy. I'm going to watch. And from my vantage point, I've got the better end of the deal. A lazy person oftentimes is a very intelligent person, a very gifted person that thinks that they're beating the system by taking advantage of other people and letting other people do it. Everybody will do it. If I just sit here on the couch long enough, she'll get up and take care of it. He'll get up and take care of it. Dad will get up and deal with it. Mom will get up and deal with it. Somebody else will deal with it. I'm getting the better end of the deal. And all in the process, a person is failing both themselves and other people. Notice chapter 20, verse 4. A sluggard does not plow in season, So at harvest, he looks, but he finds nothing. You know, during the hot time of the harvest, when the spring, when they're all out there plowing the fields and planting, the sluggard's sitting back saying, look at all those idiots out there working. And I'm just sitting back here and enjoying myself. But when the wintertime comes, after the harvest, and the sluggard has no food, the lazy person doesn't have any benefits, that's when he starts to realize that his way is not the right way. A friend was telling me about a guy that worked in his office back in the days when people actually wore coats and ties to work. And this guy that worked in his office was constantly trying to put on a front to let everybody think he's working, but he really believed in his heart, and he actually communicated how he worked to beat the system. One of the things he would do is he would take a sport coat and he would hang it permanently in his cubicle. So every time the boss came by, he would see that permanent sport coat hanging in his cubicle and always believe that the guy was working, even though he wasn't even on the premises. You know, and every couple days he'd have to change the sport coat so the boss wouldn't catch on to it. And he believed that he was beating the system, that everybody else was getting ahead, or everybody else was getting behind by working, and he was just getting ahead by loafing. Now, the results of a person who is lazy are three. Number one, the lazy person creates a drain on everyone. The lazy person creates a drain on everyone. In Proverbs 18:9, it says, one who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys. You're saying, now, wait a minute. Are you saying the lazy one is just the same or kin to a vandal or a saboteur? The Proverbs would say yes. In a subtle way, a person who does not pull their own weight, whether it's in their home, or whether it's in their employment, or whether it's at school, if a person does not pull their own weight, that person is not simply not contributing, that person is actually detracting from the overall product. When you have a boss that is counting on you, and you're 40 or 45 hours a week, but you're not putting in your 40 to 45 hours a week, somebody else has to make up for that. Somebody else has to cover it. You know, a lot of times we don't think in terms of how our behavior affects other people. You know, when you decide you're going to take an hour break in the middle of the afternoon to play solitaire on your computer, who's going to make up that hour? Who's going to do that? Who's going to take that time to make up what you didn't do that you didn't contribute? When you do something, it affects people around you. And when a person drops the ball, does not follow through on their responsibilities, it hurts others as well. And that leads us to the second result. It drives people crazy. If you're a lazy person, the people in your life will constantly be frustrated with you. Notice chapter 10, verse 26 says, as vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is a sluggard to those who send him. You send a sluggard on a mission, and you're going to be frustrated. Now, vinegar to the teeth may make your teeth hurt, but it doesn't kill you. You know, smoke in your eyes, it may give you a temporary, you know, irritate your eyes. It doesn't destroy you. And a sluggard won't ultimately undermine your whole life, but they sure make you miserable. And many of you guys have seen people that just won't pull their weight, and you're constantly frustrated with them. You look at the extra load you're carrying, and you say, you know, if that guy or that gal or that kid, if they would do their part, I wouldn't have to carry all this extra load. It's interesting that in some places, you've got employers and managers who've just come to recognize that a person's not going to pull their weight, and they redistribute their load among other people. And that makes everybody frustrated, crazy, angry. Some of you wonder why the people that you are around are constantly mad at you. And you think, you know, why would people be mad at me? I'm just an easy-go-lucky, carefree, live-and-let-live kind of guy or kind of gal. Why would anybody be mad at me? The reason why they're mad at you is because you're easy-go-lucky, you're carefree, and you don't get anything done. And so they have to do it for you. It drives people crazy. The third result, and this is the saddest of all, the lazy person lives below their potential. They live below their potential. 13:4 says the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the desires of the diligent are fully satisfied. Just because a person is lazy doesn't mean that they don't want things, but they don't get them because they won't work for them. 20:13 says, do not love sleep or you will grow poor. Stay awake and you will have food to spare. Now, I know for some of you who are recreational sleepers, you don't particularly like that verse. And there's nothing wrong with getting a good night's sleep. But for a person who's constantly looking for a way to shirk responsibilities, to get in a little bit of sleep, a little bit of slumber, a little bit of a nap, a little bit of a couch potato, you are going to always live for less than your potential. You won't ever live up to your potential. That's a very important verse in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10, where Paul says that the Christian approach to work is very simple. Paul says the rule of life in the church is if a person does not work, literally it says if a man does not work, he does not eat. That's pretty strong, isn't it? Now, Paul's not talking about somebody who has become incapacitated due to some physical illness or physical ailment. He's not talking about someone who's in a temporary situation where they've lost employment, but he's talking about someone who chronically chooses to be lazy and not contribute. That person needs to go hungry. Because you know what hunger does? Hunger creates within an individual a willingness to do something. Now, let me just speculate with you for just a moment. Could it be possible that that verse would also apply to teenagers? You know, one of the greatest things that you can do for your kids is teach them the value of work. And we've got kids who live in our homes that will not pick up their clothes. They will not clear the table. They will not cut the grass. They will not do anything unless mom or dad are standing there harping and harping and harping and harping and harping. And oftentimes parents give up. Oftentimes parents give up because it's not worth it. It's easier to take the trash out myself than to stand here for hours and yell at my child. Well, you know what? Maybe you could consider a meal that doesn't quite make it to his plate. Once or twice. Or three times. Just a thought. Just an idea. How are you going to save your kids from being lazy? And let me tell you, parents, you who have kids that you think are very gifted and very creative, those kids are, they're at risk because they can depend on their skills, they can depend on their natural gifting, but never learn discipline. And so they grow up lazy people. And some of you know what that feels like because everybody patted you on the back and made excuses for you as a child. And you grew up without having any work ethic, any discipline. You couldn't make yourself do anything. And now in life, you're miserable with yourself. And you wish somebody would have caused you to do that. Moms, let me just say a word to you. I'll say this the second hour. I didn't have time to say it in the first hour, but I wish I would have. Your boys need to learn how to wash clothes. Because if you don't teach them how to do domestic things, you know what you're going to do? You're going to turn around and you're going to pass them on to the next generation of women, and they're going to be cursing you in the same way that you're cursing your mother-in-law for never having your husband ever learn to do anything for himself around the house. And it's crazy to me to see how many moms be frustrated day to day to day because their husbands don't seem to be able to do anything for themselves, and yet they turn around and do the same thing to their sons. Hey, listen, if he can mix the chemicals together to cook up a batch of silicon at some point in time to be able to make a microchip, do you not think that he can boil water and make dinner? If he can read the instructions to figure out a software program, do you think he cannot read the instructions on the Maytag? Let us not do our children a favor by teaching them that life is simply about fun, that life is simply about doing things that I want to do, expressing myself in my gifted area. Everybody needs to learn the value of working hard. That's part of life. That keeps people from being lazy as they grow up. The second person, or the second approach, is the opposite of the lazy person. The lazy person is the no-work person. The second characteristic is the greedy person, who I would call the all-work person. It's the person who is all work, a person who's committed to financial prosperity at all cost. In this book, we see this person detailed, and let me give you some characteristics. First of all, the greedy person believes in the security of money. They believe in the security of money. In Proverbs chapter 11, verse 28, it says, "Whoever trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will thrive like a green leaf." 27:24 says, "For riches do not endure forever, and a crown is not secure for all generations." Some of us think if we can just make enough money, if we can just get on top financially, if we can make enough, then we're going to have financial security, we're going to have financial stability, that our life will be wonderful and everything will work for us. And the answer to that is that's just not true. Life does not simply consist in the pursuit of money. In fact, I don't want to get overly political here this morning, but I heard something this week that I just thought was tremendous. I was listening to news on PBS, and Jim Lehrer was interviewing our governor, George W. Bush. And he was raising the question about the campaign, and he said, "You know, how are you going to deal with this problem of, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" Because if you remember, in 1992, that was the big issue under which President Clinton ran. You know, he's the one who coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid." Basically saying that life, and certainly the presidency, revolves around one colossal issue. Are people better off financially than they were before? And so now, even now, when the question is asked, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago, everybody understands that we're only talking about one area of life, right? We're talking about money. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago financially? And so it's pretty hard to run for president when, if the major issue of the American people is money and everybody's doing well financially, how do you run against that? You know what Bush's response was to that? He said simply, "Life is not money." And my wife said, "Somebody finally said it." Like, they actually spoke it out in a public medium. Life is not money. When we ask the question, are we better off today than we were 4 years ago, is the only issue on the table money? How about morality? Is this a better place to raise kids than it was 4 years ago? Do we see more civility in our world? Do we see more compassion for people? I mean, life is a lot bigger than finances, isn't it? Whether you're Republican or Democrat, do not be duped into thinking that the role of the President of the United States is simply to line our pockets with more dollars. It's much more important than that. It's something we must all consider. But many people who are greedy believe that money is security. And if you've got money, you've got everything. Second characteristic of the greedy person is the greedy person often sacrifices the family for money. Notice in 15:27, the Proverbs say, "A greedy man brings trouble to his family, but he who hates bribes will live." A greedy person is one who's willing to put his family on the line in order to get financial gain. We've seen a lot of that in our day and age, between men and women who are willing to work inordinate amount of hours to the point where their family goes without care, without relationships. We've seen it in situations where people are literally willing to put themselves on the line financially by taking the family fortune and investing it in risky schemes, sometimes in day trading where they leverage themselves beyond their financial capability, sometimes even doing things illegal, cheating on taxes and outright stealing in order to be able to get more money. And in the process of doing that, you put your family at risk, sacrificing your family for money. The greedy person, number three, also wears himself out with work. Wears himself out with work. 23:4 says, "Do not wear yourself out to get rich. Have the wisdom to show restraint. Cast but a glance at riches and they are gone, for they will surely sprout wings and fly off like an eagle." Money is temporal. It doesn't last. And the wise person is the one who shows restraint, because you can definitely overdo it. In the pursuit of trying to get rich, you can work so hard, put so much energy into work, that you don't have anything left for any of the other priorities of your life. And all of your time, all of your emotion, all of your energy is spent and gone. And the wise person uses restraint in the pursuit of money. Number four characteristic A greedy person destroys people in the quest. In the quest for money, a greedy person will actually destroy people. 28:25 says, a greedy man stirs up dissension, but he who trusts the Lord will prosper. 29:4 says, by justice a king gives a country stability, but one who is greedy for bribes tears it down. A person who's greedy will destroy relationships and step on people to get what they want. Now, when you think about it, the majority of people in this country live in a very, very fickle world. That came home to me when I read a survey by Robert Worthnow of Princeton University, and listen to the contrast here. While 89% of Americans agree that our society is much too materialistic, 84% also say, I wish I had more money than I do. Isn't that interesting? 89% say that the country has a problem with materialism, but 84% want more money than they have. 71% believe being greedy is a sin against God. Yet 76% say having money gives me a good feeling about myself. So money makes me feel good about myself, but being greedy is a sin. Isn't that interesting? Here's one I like. 69% admire those who take a lower paying job in order to help others. And 52% want to reduce their work hours. Still, 68% would be willing to work longer hours if it meant more pay. Isn't that interesting? On the one hand, we admire people who are willing to work for less because they're doing something to contribute. We all think that we're working too many hours, yet 69% said we would work more hours if we could make more money. Society could be improved, says 71%, if people placed less emphasis on money. 71% of the people in the country say society would be improved if we placed less emphasis on money. At the same time, 80% admire those who make a lot of money by working hard. Now, isn't that interesting? On the one hand, we would say we would be improved if we didn't worship the cult of money. But 80% of us continue to do it anyway. Those percentages, 71 and 80, they kind of got to overlap. You know, some of these are the same people. It's the strange, fickle, kind of crazy association that we have with money. Where on the one hand, we'll speak out of our head and we'll say, yeah, money isn't everything. It doesn't buy happiness. It's not the goal of the world. But out of our lives, we say a different thing by the way we work and the way we go and the way we go after it. I was at a management seminar one time, and a guy was telling about people who struggle for the almighty dollar, and he shared about a guy who was the president of a corporation. He was a guy that was tall, really handsome, good communicator. He was the president of a corporation, and at the end of the meeting, he came up to the management consultant with tears running down his face, and he said, I absolutely hate my life. I hate what I'm doing. All my life, I've been pushed into positions of leadership. Everybody said, you be the leader, you be the boss, you be in charge. And he said, all my life, I've worked and spent every single ounce of energy to the detriment of my family, to the detriment of my kids, trying to keep up with all this pressure that I feel to stay on top and do what everybody wants me to do. And I've never had the courage to do something different. And through consulting with this individual, this management consultant gave him the courage to do something else. And you know what he did? He became a personal assistant to another leader in the corporation. Took a huge cut in pay. And whenever you see this guy, he's got a great smile on his face. Because now he's doing something. He's making less money, but he loves it. It's life again. He has time and energy to give to other people. And so many of us worship the careers that pay the big bucks, even though we might not personally have the gifting to be able to pull that off and balance the rest of life. Now let me ask you, who's more valuable? Who's more valuable, a doctor or a plumber? Who's more valuable? Who's more valuable? Who's more valuable, a lawyer or a carpenter? Who's more valuable? Who has more intrinsic worth? You know, some of us were designed to be lawyers. We've been given the gifting to keep a number of balls in the air at the same time in a very intense environment and to do well at it. Go do it. Some of us haven't. And we shouldn't be trying to do something that is going to take every single ounce of our energy, thus robbing all the people in our lives of the good things that we have to offer to them. And why do we do that? Are we doing it simply for finances? It's time to evaluate. Am I a greedy person? Now that leads us to the last characteristic, and that's the dishonest person. If the lazy person is the no-work person and the greedy person is the all-work person, the dishonest person I call the low-work person. And oftentimes, because a person's lazy but they want material gain or they're greedy, that drives them toward dishonesty. The first characteristic of the dishonest person or approach is the in-your-face approach. Notice in chapter 1, verse 11, it says, "If they say, 'Come along with us, let us lie in wait for someone's blood, let us waylay some harmless soul,'" it's talking about being invited to join a group of people that are there to go steal in your face. Going to go up and rob you. And when we think of that, we think of somebody walking into a convenience store, pointing the gun at them, you know, saying, "Hey, give me your money or I'm going to take your life." But you know, there are a lot of other ways to steal besides that in your face. I was talking to my wife, and she had a friend one time that was sharing with her how she cut down on her grocery bill. She said the best way to cut down on your grocery bill is when you get to the checkout line, hand the person a whole wad of coupons. Cindy said, "Well, you know, what if they don't match, I don't have that many coupons that match what I'm buying." And the gal said, "Oh, I'm not talking about matching what you got. Just hand her a whole wad that's so big that she won't stop and check." And she said, most of the time, the checker will just kind of take them off the price and never bother to pay attention that that's what you bought or what you didn't. And Cindy was just aghast. She said to the woman, "Well, isn't that stealing?" And the woman said to her, "Well, you know, the grocery store has lots of money. It's a big chain." What she is advocating doing and what she actually did in her day-to-day practice is no different than if she tapped the checker on the shoulder and said, "Look over there," and reached behind her back and took money out of the cash register. That is stealing. That is stealing. One of the vice presidents at 3M was sharing with a friend of mine one time. He was the vice president in charge of office supplies for the corporation, selling office supplies for major corporations. And during that particular year when they had this conversation, there were a number of companies around the world that had laid off a big chunk of their white-collar workforce. And he made the comment that sales would be down on scotch tape to these big corporations this year, because every year these corporations place large orders for scotch tape because their employees steal all the scotch tape to wrap Christmas presents. Now, what's the difference between taking scotch tape from your workplace or taking it off the shelves when you walk through shoplifting out of a store? You say, "Well, the difference is they owe it to me, right? They don't pay me all that I deserve, right? I've worked here a long time. I deserve this treatment, right?" Those are the ways that we justify being dishonest. That's stealing. Second approach is the behind your back stealing. Behind your back. In 11:1 it says, "The Lord abhors dishonest scales, but accurate weights are his delight." What he's talking about here is that in the marketplace, a merchant would fix the scales in such a way that they would always give him the advantage. So when you put your stuff on there and you thought you were buying a pound, you were actually buying less than a pound. What about in our current world today when we make promises that a product will perform in a certain way and we know good and well that product won't do that? Is that not being dishonest? I mean, the person's actually depending on our word. They're paying us money to do something and we're telling them it'll do it, but we know that it won't do it. Or we're saying that we can deliver a certain interest rate, or we can deliver a certain service by a certain time, and the person's depending on that, paying us for it, and we know good and well that's not going to happen. What are we saying? We're saying we're going behind your back, we're willing to take your money so that we get wealthy, so that we get our stuff, but we're not honest in what we're doing for people. That's a form of dishonesty. The third way I call over your dead body. Over your dead body. In 11:26 it says, "People curse the man who hoards grain, but blessing crowns him who is willing to sell." In other words, in an agrarian economy, every once in a while, when the crops didn't grow and there wasn't much food, the rich guy who had extra because he had a bigger farm, if he decides not to sell to all the poor guys, what does that do to them? Puts them out of business, doesn't it? Like, if he doesn't sell them, they can't plant. They don't have anything next year. And he says that a person who voluntarily takes the livelihood from other people simply to make more money, that's a form of dishonesty. Look at 28:8. He says, he who increases his wealth by exorbitant interest amasses it for another who will be kind to the poor. We say, it's the market, it's the market, it's just the way we do business. People get burned in this kind of an economy. But if you set out with your company and the desire of your heart is to take away the livelihood of other people, and particularly if they don't have recourse or another way to make a living, and the reason why you're doing that is primarily for money, you've got to ask yourself the question, do I care about people at all? Or is this simply about me and about my pocketbook? You know, some people brag about putting others out of work. Is that a goal? That is behind, or that's what I call over your dead body. That's the low work practices. I want you to turn to one passage in Proverbs as we wrap up, and that's Proverbs chapter 30, verses 7 through 9. Proverbs chapter 30, verses 7 through 9. This is a great passage. In Proverbs chapter 30, verse 7, Agur is saying, God, I need something from you. I got two requests. He says, two things I ask of you, O Lord. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep falsehood and lies far from me. In other words, let me live in a world of honesty, honest relationships. And then secondly, he says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. What an interesting request. God, give me just enough. Teach me how to live on just enough. If I get rich, I may forget you and say, I've got all I need. I don't need you anymore. Or if I'm poor, I may get hungry and steal. Money is an incredible temptation. And being on the extreme, extremely poor or extremely rich, will cause people to do crazy things. The goal of life is not money. The goal of life is to take the gifting that God has given us and to serve Him in a way that pleases Him. When the late Walt Disney died, the people in his studio thought, man, we're going to get a break now. Walt Disney, a perfectionist, a craftsman, an expert in his trade, used to drive his employees to work really hard to produce the most excellent product. And many of them thought, now that he's dead, it's going to relax around here. A year after his death, everybody got a memo saying to come to the conference room. There they sat down in the conference room, and the lights went off, and up on the screen came Walt Disney. Before Walt Disney died, he recorded one final message for his employees, the leaders of his company, to be played after his death. And there Walt Disney sat behind his desk, and he looked them all in the eye, and he called them all by name, and he said to them, you know, I want you to live up to the standards that we've established for this company, and you better keep up with it, because I'm going to see you again. Now, I don't know what that meant. I don't know if he meant that it's going to be hot where you're going and I'm going to be there with you, or it's going to be nice where you're going and I'm going to be there with you. I don't know what he meant. But Walt Disney, even from the grave, was reaching out and reminding people to be honest, to do a good day's work, to value the way you approach life. Jesus Christ is ultimately going to sit down with each of us and give an evaluation for what we did with our lives. Let's not be lazy. Let's not be greedy. Let's not be dishonest. Let's give Jesus Christ our best. Father in heaven, we just thank you that you've given us our day, you've given us our time, and you've given us the ability to serve you. Father, we thank you for the graciousness of this gift called life. May we use it to bring glory to you in all that we do. For we pray these things in Jesus' precious name and for his glory. Amen.